everyone, this is Simone Davis and welcome to the Montessori Notebook Podcast. I'm really happy to be with you today to be able to spread a bit of peace and positivity into your homes, and I hope that you and your families are all doing well, that you're staying positive and maybe just taking it one day at a time right now. So to distract you perhaps, or at least to inspire you, I have a conversation to share with you today with Nicole from the Kavanaugh Report. She has 4 children and a dog, and she makes it look easy. So I get to ask her lots of questions about the things that come up between siblings, dealing with different ages, what she's learning even with her 4th child and how that's different. And you also see her beautiful intentional spaces on Instagram. So I ask her about that, as well as, you know, things like maximum effort, where the children are working like their whole body. We get into the practical life activities that her children love, and even some of her favorite thrifting finds. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy that conversation. But before we get started with that conversation, I am going to talk to you about something a little bit different today. It's about Ayurveda. So I touched on this in the very first episode of this season, and people asked to know more. So you may think that the link between Ayurveda and Montessori is a little tenuous, but it's actually, for me, a really valuable way that I can practice Montessori. So I'm always looking for a book or something like that that can help me parent in a Montessori way or become a better Montessori teacher. And I feel like Ayurveda has definitely supported me since I've been interested in it, I think since 2016. And I was listening to a podcast by Halle Poole, which I highly recommend, and I'll put in the show notes. I also did an Ayurvedic consultation with Tori Heinemann, who's based here in Amsterdam. And she also does some online Ayurvedic yoga practices through the House of Yoga, which I go to all the time. I do the same 3 over and over again, depending on how I'm feeling in my body. And that's the thing about Ayurveda. It's not so much a diet or anything like this. What Ayurveda is, it's a, you know, thousands of years old, comes out of India, and it's basically being able to look at yourself and having some self-awareness to see how you're feeling right now. So in Ayurveda, there's 3 doshas. There's Kapha, Pitta, and Vata. And basically all these doshas are in balance, or one's a little bit more out of balance usually than others. So if you have your Vata out of balance, Vata's great because that's your creativity, but too much Vata and you can feel scattered, you have too many ideas, you feel overwhelmed or stressed. Or if you've got too much Pitta's great because it's your drive and your passion, but too much of it means that you're stressed or you're angry or you've got too much fire basically in you. And Kapha, if you've got too much Kapha, you often feel sluggish and lethargic, but actually Kapha can be very beautiful when it's in balance because it's our grounding energy and the very earthy kind of energy. So I love this philosophy because I'm able to kind of look at myself. I'm usually quite Vata Pitta, and if I'm feeling too, you know, scattered and airy, then I know that I need to do one, like the yoga practice that's for Vata, which is very grounding and very slow moving, which is very difficult for me. Then I often do a sesame oil massage in the evenings, which is called Abhyanga, and you basically, I have some tiny little jars and I put a little bit of sesame oil in and warm that up, and then you can massage that on and then wash it off in the shower. You can leave it on actually even for 20 minutes if you want to soak it in, but I'm sometimes too lazy to do that. Then I also know that I need to eat more cooked foods if I'm feeling very Vata, rather than going for light, airy foods like some crackers or something like this. And definitely no coffee at that time because I definitely already have enough energy. I also get really dry skin when I'm Vata. It's like a very airy kind of quality to you. So it's nice to know, okay, this is a bit out of balance and this is how I can bring myself back a little bit more into balance. If I'm feeling too Pitta, then I know that I'm usually pushing myself too hard, and working too hard is usually my problem. So again, I would do a yoga practice for too much Pitta, which means it's often, a slower practice. And it's not about, you know, trying to get the, going into the postures the deepest, you know, like sometimes we just push ourselves too hard. No hot and spicy foods at that time, kind of like take back all the chilies and garlic and all those kind of things that can heat up our bodies. And you can even wear cooling colors to, you know, help actually cool down your system. My sister also swears by the pitta tea that I sent her, which has got some really calming herbs in it as well. And then kaffir, I'm not so good at because I don't tend to have too much kaffir very often. But if in holiday periods, for example, when you're feeling a bit more lethargic, or perhaps if you're feeling restless in quarantine mode, then you can do a more dynamic yoga practice. And you might even be able to handle a little bit of coffee at times like this. So what I love about this is that you can just check in with yourself. How am I feeling? And there's definitely no work-life balance or balance in life, but it is a way that you can get a little bit more balance. So when people say, how do you stay such a calm teacher and calm with your children? It's about actually taking care of myself and keeping myself as much as possible in balance so that I can then be less reactive and I can respond better as well. And then just another personal thing that I really appreciate about the Ayurvedic approach is it's just so moderate. So it's not full of like, you're not allowed to eat this and you're not allowed to do that. There's like, for example, they don't believe in detoxing because you're never meant to tax your system that much that you need to then do a detox. They definitely do have a beautiful meal called khichdi, or it's sometimes called khichdi, and it's a rice meal. So if your system has been a little bit taxed, you know, after holiday seasons or something like that, then you can eat khichdi every day, and it's kind of like a cleansing meal that's not difficult on your digestive system and easy to process. And it's actually a really balanced meal that's got a little bit of fat, the ghee that they cook with. It's got rice, it's got mung beans for protein, it has green vegetables, the extractive qualities like broccoli and spinach, and then warming vegetables like pumpkin or carrot and those kind of things. So that can be really comforting as well. So not only can you do it for yourself, you can also notice it in your children. And maybe that's something that would be useful for you to look more into. Lately, I've even, I did a workshop about the Yoga Sutras and Ayurveda. And so I read the book called Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and it's about living in a yogic way. And I found that really interesting and also really supportive. And I really feel compliments the Montessori approach. So I hope you find that little introduction to Ayurveda interesting. I'm definitely by no means trained in it. So I may not have exactly explained everything completely perfectly, but I hope that you get the idea. And now let's not wait any longer. Let's get into my conversation with Nicole, and I'll be back after our conversation to answer another listener question. I'm very excited to introduce a very special guest today, Nicole Cavanaugh from The Cavanaugh Report. Thanks for joining us, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
This is so delightful. I think that this will be really valuable for people because I think everyone thinks, well, Montessori would be fine if I had like, if I only have one child, but actually what's it like with more children? And Nicole, do you want to introduce your family for us?
Sure. So I'm Nicole Cavanaugh. I write at the Cavanaugh Report, and I have four children. Henry, my oldest, is 9. Or very, very newly 9. My second child, Nora. Nora is 5.5. Gus is 3. And Theodore, or Teddy, is 4 months. So a lot of humans.
Yeah, we call that the happy handfuls at this end.
Yes, from the entire spectrum of ages. And I'm getting confused now. I have to like keep them all in line. There's so many of them.
But it's really fun for this conversation as well, because you've got some two planes of children, what we call in Montessori. So two children in the 0 to 6 years, and two children in the 6 to 12 plane. And so maybe that's a fun conversation as well to see how, you know, things differ in the different planes of development.
It's really interesting. Yeah. So, and Nora's right on that cusp. So I'm seeing all these signs of like switching from this sort of younger absorbent mind period to the second plane of development, where some really exciting changes happen. And so that's really fun for me to watch that with this now that I've done it once before.
Yeah, that's really fun. All right, well, let's get into that soon. I wanted to just jump back into maybe your childhood and anything that you remember, you know, could be traumatic, could be great, but something that had a big impact on you that you think has maybe influenced how you parent your own children.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this, and the moment that kept coming back to me was the moment when my littlest brother was born. And I think just because of where I'm at right now, I'm the oldest of four children, and my youngest brother is the fourth baby. And so I was around 8 years old when he was born. Oh, so almost exactly the same age that Henry was when Theodore was born. And my came home from school. Like, I vividly remember coming home from school and my dad was there, which was unusual. And he's like, guess what? Your mom had the baby. And we were so excited. And I have there's a set of twins that are 14 months younger than me. And so the three of us were there and we were all so excited. And he goes, guess what? It wasn't even a baby. It was a puppy. And we're so thrilled. Just the absolute enjoyment and thrill and magic of that moment of, wow, we are getting a puppy. And it was totally lost on us until we literally went into the hospital room that this is actually a baby. And so that sort of lighthearted and fun and sort of magical feeling and being really equally parts, so thrilled to have this new baby brother and we're really thinking we were getting a dog. It's just such a fun experience for us. And that moment, for some reason, is one of those highlights of my childhood that I just hope that my children can have that kind of fun and whimsy with us as parents and still be so thrilled to just be this family unit together and welcoming in that new child. And I just think of how much excitement I felt in that moment and really relating to my own children now, having just had a baby. That they get to sort of experience that for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that your role is so different now with four children. It's very different to when you just had one Henry or even, you know, two or three children. How do you feel like it's changed?
It's true. You go from micromanaging it. Actually, I think it's easier in a way to have more children because you have to let something go. And so you just get to sit back a little bit instead of micromanaging or feeling so much pressure to be with your child all of the time. I think there's just a certain amount of I can't do it all. And so that's okay. And we're just gonna sit back and let this be and let them show me who they are. And they're all so different. Every single one of my children they have far more differences than they do similarities. And to watch that and to see that beauty unfold is so it's so special. And it's one of those things that I really cherish about having a bigger family. And to just get to experience the world through each one of their eyes has been such an incredible blessing and an experience in and of itself.
Yeah. And I guess you're more setting the family culture at this point, as opposed to, micromanaging every little thing that happens or any dispute that happens or some frustration that each child has. You can't be there for every moment. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, you really can't. I mean, I think there are some people that try and there are sometimes parents feel this guilt, they need to step in for every single conflict or every single moment or, just really be absolutely intensely into everything your child is doing. You just can't do that when you have, three, four children. It was a little easier with two, but by four children, no. And so you get to see that big picture and you get to be the model a lot more than the referee. Mm-hmm. And I think just being that person of calm and stepping in where you need to really gives you a sense of peace and wonder and just being with your children in a different kind of way.
So it can be relaxing actually having four children.
Yes. Yes. That's a secret, everyone. Keep having more babies and your life gets easier. No, I mean, there are other things that are, of course, it's a lot of work to put four kids to bed. But it can be a lot more relaxing, from a day-to-day moment, I think. Three was the hardest transition for us, but four has been really sort of blissful.
Yeah, it feels that way when I look at your Instagram feed. It feels relaxing and watching Teddy just fit into the family so beautifully.
Right, yeah, he just kind of slides in.
Yeah, perfect. And sleep-wise and rest-wise, do you get any sleep? Do you get any rest?
Well, I was up pretty much every hour last night, so no. We do. We're not worrying about it yet. You know, Teddy's only 4 months old. And so I think it's to be expected. He sleeps like a baby, which is getting up. And so we get up. But yeah, it can be challenging to get enough giant chunks of sleep. Some nights he'll sleep 8 hours straight and some nights he's up every hour. I don't really feel that rhythm yet. And so what's challenging is when you have like one child who's sick and then you're getting up with one child and then you have a newborn, and then, you know, that sort of can really cut down on your sleep. But I haven't slept in 10 years, so I feel like I'm okay with my sleep being pretty interrupted. Those of you who follow me on Instagram know that my children are not sleepers, but I tend to not be the greatest sleeper either. I tend to be a burn the midnight oil and get up at the crack of dawn. So kind of person. So I guess it probably shouldn't surprise me that my children are also pretty active at night.
Yeah. So are there ways that you rest during the day, like to take care of yourself so that you can give, you know, your energy to all these humans under your roof?
Yeah. I mean, I try to keep my commitments light. I think that's one of the biggest things I do for my own sort of mental health and my own self-care. And I say no to things a lot. I don't commit to every party and every, you know, gymnastics class that we could be doing or sport event or whatever it is. Just allowing ourselves to have sort of a slower start to our days. And I'm very fortunate that my husband's work schedule is such that he can take the kids to school so that I can be home a little bit more and sort of give myself that relaxing time. I also, if my children are playing happily, I feel zero guilt in picking up a book and, you know, taking 10 minutes to read while my children are, you know, around. I don't feel like I have to engage them in every moment of every day. And then again, if you follow me on Instagram, you know, baths are my life. Like I am there for my bath every night, and that is my ultimate self-care.
Yeah. I'm a bath fan myself.
I know I can't, you cannot like, I, there's very few things that are going to get me to not take my like nightly bath with my fancy Epsom salts and just zone out for a while. And yeah, it's so important to me to have that time.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk siblings as well. How do you feel about, you know, giving each of them the attention that they need? You know, I'm sure things come up like one child being sick and those kind of things. How do you actually manage when a child's sick and someone else is asking for something else? What are your children used to hearing? How do you manage those kind of things?
They're used to being asked to help. And I think they're so, and one of the beautiful things about the Montessori method is that we're giving them those opportunities to really sort of be independent and feel meaningful and do meaningful work from a really young age. And so when we're dealing with a situation where, you know, let's say Nora is sick and Gus wants, you know, a glass of water, it's Gus, I see that your pitcher is on the counter. Would you be able to get it for yourself this time while I help Nora? Or could you get Nora a glass of water as well? And giving them that sort of role in an agency over what we're doing sort of really helps them focus. And that's not always the case. There are always times where, you know, my children are fighting. They're normal children. You know, they'll be fighting with each other and screaming. And then you have to take that more active role. And at that point, you just hope the baby is also happy. And know that it's okay to feel frustration, and it's okay to feel sadness, and it's okay to feel boredom, and that it's not my job as a parent to keep them from feeling all of those emotions at any one point. So if the baby has to feel frustrated that I put him down for 2 minutes, he can feel frustrated, and I don't feel guilt over that. That's a normal human emotion. If I know that his needs are otherwise met, and I need to help, you know, Nora, you know, please use your words with Gus. Gus is feeling frustrated about this or whatever it might be. I can allow myself the grace to let them feel those feelings and know that I don't need to keep them happy every second of every day. And if I try to keep them happy every second of every day, I'm going to drive myself, you know, to a place where I'm unhappy with my life situation. So I just really need to, you know, keep that in mind. It's balancing, and it's a continuous and like just letting go and letting us all experience that full range of, you know, there are times when I'm frustrated or hungry or sad or whatever. And not labeling those as negative emotions as much as just part of the human experience.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Just that reframe is like, oh, actually, why is that just a, like, why are we trying to sweep it away or not let it come up? It comes up, we name it or we help them through it, but it doesn't have to not exist at all. And there are those moments then, you said, like when I do need to step in, like something escalates. Do you feel that happens from time to time?
Oh, it happens daily. Yeah. They're regular kids. And so I think there is sometimes a perception on social media in general that children are always these like happy, frappy humans. And that perception from my social media and is an intentional choice not to put my children on display in moments when they might not be able to consent to being on display. And so if they're in a frustrated or angry place or they're doing something that maybe is not what we would consider like best or typical behavior for them, I might not post that just because I don't want them to feel like I'm taking advantage of that situation in order to educate others. And so I do ask from time to time if I can post something where they're frustrated. But so there's a sense that maybe they don't fight, but they do fight. They're normal, normal siblings, and they get into squabbles over who should get to play with the farm and who should get to open the door and who's going to be the one to cut the carrot. And at those moments, I talk them through it as best I can. And my number one goal is to keep everybody physically safe. So especially with having young children, we're sort of coming a little bit out of this with Gus being 3 now, but hitting and biting are still a thing, right? And so physical safety is my number one goal, and making sure that I'm present in a physical way so that I can block them, you know, just gently using either my hand or keeping some distance between them so that nobody gets physically hurt. And then talking them through the situation, I think I can recognize that Gus is frustrated because his body was slower to grab, you know, whatever knife he wanted to use. And now Nora has that knife and she wants to use it and she's going to take it from him. So he's feeling frustrated in that moment. And he doesn't necessarily have the words to say, "I'm feeling frustrated, Nora. I was hoping to use that knife." And so if I can step in and just sort of name those things for him, "Gus, you're feeling frustrated," or "Gus is feeling frustrated." Usually I try to keep it more neutral and talk to both of them. "Gus is feeling frustrated. He was hoping to use the knife, but Nora has the knife." And then it might be just enough. Just saying that might be enough for Nora to say, "Oh, I can use my other knife," and give it back to him. She might not even realize like what had happened, or just keep talking them through that situation. Or she doesn't want to give up the knife. "Oh, we have these other knives over here. I wonder if they could be of use in this situation," or, you know, whatever it ends up being. But just talking them through sometimes that problem solving, conflict resolution stages can be really helpful without sort of it trying to impose consequences or punishments or otherwise source of those sorts of things. Just let them sit with their own feelings, name those feelings for them, and then as much as I can, like, try to help them and guide them and scaffold them to coming up with a solution. Because then as they move into that second plane, like, this conversation between Nora and Henry would be very different. What we mean by second plane of development is ages 6+. So over 6 to 12. And as they move into that period, the conflict needs to be sort of given more into their own hands so that they're coming up with those solutions on their own. And so I just want to give them tools, as, you know, especially in that 3 to 6 year old age range, where they're, you know, having some agency, but I'm still directing, you know, that conversation.
Thank you. And I guess this is a good jumping off point then to move into the differences between these two, you know, stages of childhood. And then it goes on, obviously, from 12 to 18 and 18 to 24, but that doesn't apply yet in your situation. We'll have to come back to that one in a few years.
Yeah, hopefully not too quickly.
Exactly. It won't happen too fast. So say, Henry, what do you notice is a difference between a first plane child and a second plane child with Henry?
So there are huge differences. And I think just the way that they organize information and their interests, and I don't mean interests in like my kid likes cars or my kid likes animals. I mean, in like their actual way that they see the world, 3 to 6 year old children or 0 to 6 year old children even are so interested in the concrete realities around them. And so that sort of disappears in an interesting way when you get to 6 to 7, 8, you know, as you're moving into that second plane. And they start to become interested in the relationships around them and where am I in this where do I fit in and how am I contributing and where is my role in all of this? And it's less like, look at that awesome bird. It's like, how do we keep those birds safe? Like, why are those birds, you know, where do those birds live and how is that, you know, in relationship to where I am and how, what is my role in caring for this? And what is our role as a human being to protect that? And the questions just get so much deeper and interesting. And the relationship that can develop there is, it's just, it's on a whole new plane and a whole new, it just really is like starting new again. And it's been really beautiful to watch that. And then practically all those beautiful little ordered moments that you have with your 0 to 6 year old child putting their toys back on their shelves in such a lovely fashion just seems to disappear. Their sense of order just melts away.
They say the external order goes and they've got internal order, but the external order, yeah, it's not important to them at that moment.
Right. Yeah. So they're internally, they're very structured, very ordered, especially when it comes to like social arrangements, like this is who we play with and this is how we play. And what is my role in this group setting is very orderly. Like they can tell you everything that has happened at school with so-and-so had this for lunch and we had this and that. And, you know, they're all very like group orientated. But yeah, if, ask them to put their laundry in their laundry basket. And it's like, why would, what? Like it doesn't even occur to them anymore.
That's so interesting. Really fun to see the differences, definitely. And also what I love seeing is the, how you use your spaces to also help having, you know, with four children, your spaces are like another parent because they can help themselves. And you've been very intentional with how you've created your spaces and they're constantly evolving. I love seeing that you've switched things out and how the spaces have evolved as the children get older. Would you like to speak on that?
Yeah. So, right. So in Montessori, we have a prepared environment and whether or not you're in a classroom or you're at home, preparing your space really is like another parent. It really becomes, it becomes a lot of the limit setting so that I don't have to personally take that role. My environment does it for me. And it does change. I mean, what Teddy needs at 4 months old is so completely different from what Henry needs at 9 years old. And so to look at each one of them and prepare a space that fits their needs. And so for that older child, it's going to be space, like physical space to do these big projects because they're thinking about like all of this stuff and how does it fit together and where am I in all of this? And so they're going to grab research books and they're going to want to do big works that are going to sit out. They don't care if it looks neat anymore. So they want it like to like sit out all that scraps of cardboard that they're using for like, I don't know, whatever they're building. It's always something, right? And that they need space for that to just sit and to be and to have it. And then Teddy and Gus and Nora, you know, they're still need that order and they need that discipline of like, they need to know exactly where their stuff should be found and where I should get that stuff from and what's available to me to do right now based on what's in my environment and how do I use it based on what's in my environment. And so to have that sort of orderly space while also allowing for some of the chaos and exploration that happens in the second plane is probably my biggest challenge, having such a large age group of children, you know, being that they're 8.5-ish. Yeah, I think 8.5 almost exactly years apart. Yeah, that's probably my biggest challenge with spaces is how do you allow for that chaos of the second plane and this really different way of seeing the world and interacting with the world and those little kids that are still in our house that very much need that order and that consistency and they can't run around with scissors, right? Like Teddy shouldn't have a knife yet. And so how do you keep those guys safe too? Can be a challenge.
Well, I noticed, like, for example, that Teddy does have like a corner of the playroom, which is his with the mirror and a movement mat and his space. And then there's spaces for the younger ones. And then I guess these other spaces as well. And so there's some definition of who belongs where. And there's obviously a lot of flexibility with that because, you know, of course, Gus is going to come over and give Teddy a hug. It's not that he's not allowed there, but it is set out for everything that Teddy needs in that moment. And also then I notice on the shelves, you have containers that have you know, tighter lid so that Teddy's not going to, when he's crawling, be able to get into all the small beads and parts like this that is unsafe for him. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So it's just using the space that you have and thinking really creatively on how can I incorporate everybody into this space, but still give them what they need. And so that often is locking boxes are your friend when you have multiple children. Get yourself a toddler that can open a box with a key. So that's why I love introducing lock and key work as little toddlers. Because if you're thinking about having more babies, being able to put little tiny beads into a locked box is a huge advantage, because then your baby crawls over, grabs that locked box off the shelf. There's nothing you can do about that. They're just going to come over and take it off. And they just want to explore it, right? And if they can shake it and like, what a wonderful sound that is. Awesome. I can like shake it and it makes a noise, or I can bang it upside down and, you know, great. You can allow for that exploration. Give yourself a breather. You don't have to feel like this tension of stepping in all the time, but you're still keeping your baby safe. And so just using some of those like tiny little things can create this prepared environment, but really take the stress off of you, take the stress off your baby, take the stress off your toddler, that the environment is working as it should. And so, yes, in our playroom, you'll find we just did a huge rearrange because the space just wasn't working with three children in a smaller, we were in a smaller art space. And as my children have moved into the second plane now with two of them sort of in that cusp of the second plane, we just do a lot of art projects and a lot of bigger work, and it wasn't working in the smaller space. So we moved to the bigger space, and now sort of balancing Gus's need for tray work and smaller manipulatives and his desire to do art because he's three and he's developing that hand and he wants to start writing and doing all of those things. And so giving him some space to work with trays, giving him some space to work with art, giving the big kids art space, but still having Theodore in that room. And so I have physically blocking things off, just rearranging shelves to like sort of create natural barriers so that when Theodore does start moving, he's got to roll or move or crawl all the way around this shelf, or this, in our case, it's a little Practical Life water station, move all the way around that in order to find some of those materials that might be a little more difficult for him to have, and then create those tricks on the shelf where they're in boxes or they're up higher, or they're, you know, in a container that he can't open. Just using that space to our advantage. And also we put it on the side where there's like the big door that goes outside. So hopefully by that point, when he's starting to crawl, it's like, actually just crawl outside. Let's go out there. Instead of playing with the perler beads or, you know, sewing needles or whatever variety of things that he's just not going to be ready for at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, Gus in the middle there, still in this three-year-old phase. And I see that like he's starting to get interested in sounds, and you've got a felt map with different animals, land, sea animals, those kind of things. What kind of things has he been showing interest in at the moment? And what's your balance between having Montessori materials at home and they're going to school and things like that as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. Gus is sort of in a unique position because his birthday is at the end of November. And so he turned three at the end of November, but the school year starts in August. And while he could have gone to a children's house, we could have sent him in January. Actually, he probably could have even started a little earlier than that based on the school where we send our kids. They start at 33 months. So we could have sent him, but my children go to a public Montessori starting in first grade. And based on our state's laws, you have to be 6 years old. You can't be five. And so that meant he was going to spend 4 years in children's house, and if he went this year. And so we decided that financially was difficult to send him for an extra year. And social emotionally, he probably just didn't need to spend 4 years in children's house. And so we have this sort of unique position that he's got this sort of what I am calling a gap year. You know, it's just, he's not quite a toddler, and he's ready for a lot of this three-year-old work that you would find in a children's house environment. He's not going to children's house. So I don't want him to you know, I hate to say the word bored because I do think boredom is good. But I don't want him to feel underserved and under-challenged. And I want him to have the materials that he's ready for at this moment, even if, you know, he can't be in that school environment. So at the moment, we're in a really unique position that I am pulling out some Montessori materials that you would typically find just in a school. If you notice back when Nora was three, she went to Children's House for birthdays in the summer. So she just went to Children's House when she was a little over three, and we never had any of this material out. And so for us, I want to balance that. I want to give them the academic materials that they're ready for once they're ready for them. But I also want to keep Children's House and their schools special. So right now, Gus is very into sound games and very into the sandpaper letters. So we're starting to like blend some of the letter learning and sound learning. He's starting to get into numbers and he counts very well abstractly because he's got older siblings who have modeled that for him, despite the fact that I've never, ever done that with him myself. And he can count to like 30. And I'm like, how do you know this? It's that absorbent mind just like in work. So we're kind of trying to back that up a little bit and do some more concrete work because as you know, Montessori starts their mathematics from a concrete moving to the abstract. So we want to make sure that he can concretely do that. So there's some of that. And then there's some of just that interest in the world around them. What are the continents and where do animals live? And we do that very, very relaxed. It's just on his pace. We don't have a set, like this is our work time. You have to work with these materials or anything like that. It's just whenever he feels like he wants to use that work, we do it. And we make that part of our routine when he's feeling like he wants that. So it's sort of a unique position. But if he was in Children's House, I probably would be looking for less traditional materials that sort of complement the work that he was doing, but not necessarily replicating that, because I don't think you honestly need to have, you know, a full set of materials in your house and then a full set of materials at school. It sort of takes away a lot of that wonder that happens.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also you might present it in a way that's different to how they presented at school, and that would actually almost undeserve the child.
Exactly, moment. Yeah. And you don't want to take that away and make it more difficult for them to like understand what the rules are at school or anything like that. So I totally respect any materials that I've had out for Nora, who's been in Children's House. She's in her kindergarten year in Children's House now. Have been after talking to her guide or compliment her work. I think the only thing that I have out right now for her is the movable alphabet because she just wants to write. But she's still developing those hand skills. And so that movable alphabet really gives her that opportunity to practice some of those writing skills without needing always a pen and paper.
And I'm sure some parents are kind of curious who aren't so familiar with the Montessori approach. What is like a sound game that Gus is into? How do you play that with him?
Oh, so such a fun and easy way to incorporate Montessori in your home. And so sound games are basically what we would call I Spy. And sort of looking at objects, you can take any object that you have in your home. We sometimes use little language miniatures, but you can honestly use toys. You can use food. We've played this like at the breakfast table too. And it's just saying, I spy something that begins with B. And we start with one thing. So it might be a plate with a banana on it. I spy something that begins with B. Banana! You did it! We have a banana. Bananas start with B. And then we'll add two things. So then it might be we have oatmeal and bananas for breakfast. And then we have two things there. And it's I spy something that begins with B. Oh, you found it. The banana starts with B. I spy something that begins with oatmeal's a terrible example because it's not phonetic. let's think of something. Waffles. oatmeal is a bad example if you're unfamiliar, because O is not a phonetic sound. It's the OA together that make the odd phonogram there.
But we get the idea, and then you'd just be W instead. And I think it's really beautiful for people to hear that instead of saying that it starts with B, we use the phonetic sound, and we're basically then scaffolding on, aren't we, so that they learn the sounds and then they'll be able to do what Nora's doing, which is actually writing first, like sounding out words and putting it down the movable alphabet, and not the reading where they synthesize the sounds might come as a separate step.
A completely separate step. And so it's really fantastic then, because you can see that glimpse into their own thoughts when they're starting to write before they can really read super proficiently, but they can write these incredible stories and sentences and sound out all of these words. And the movable alphabet is just like basically a set of letters that are just, you know, like letter magnets, but not magnets. They can just play with those letters and really create these fantastic stories and thoughts. And it's just the genius of the Montessori method unfolding before you. But yeah, for a toddler, it's real fun. It can be really relaxed. We started around age 2.5 with him, and he's just over 3 now. And it's just relaxed. And we play, at the breakfast table. We play with some language objects. I might have a little bowl of tiny little objects like fairy garden stuff, or you can find those like little animals or whatever it is that he's interested in. And we pick 2 or 3 out and we play that game. And once they get the beginning sounds, then you can work with the ending sounds and those middle sounds. And it's really just helping them start to listen more closely to the words in terms of sound instead of just naming the object, which toddlers are so interested in. You know, toddlers just want to say like, that's a cat, right? And a preschooler, you know, in that 3 to 6 age range, you know, it's cat, it's a cat. Like, they can really start to break up those sounds in a new way, which is really exciting and such an easy, fun way to interact with your child and play that game while doing some really deep learning.
Yeah, that's really fun. The other thing that I always get really impressed about seeing on your Instagram is your children cooking in the kitchen, particularly Nora. I think she was really a big fan of Practical Life. So I'd see her making pancakes, I think, and pretty much anything. But would you this is part of Practical Life, involving them in daily life, but then scaffolding the skills so they're doing things independently. Do you want to talk about some of Nora's favorites?
Sure. Yeah. So Nora in particular loves cooking. And this is another thing that I love about Montessori, is it gives them all their own ability to do and follow their own interests. And so Gus has had every opportunity that Nora has had in the kitchen. He just isn't as interested. And so he doesn't do it as often. But Nora in particular just loves to be in the kitchen. She will bake anything. This morning it was blueberry muffins, which I enjoy because I get to eat blueberry muffins and I like them. She can cook a lot. She probably has similar cooking skills that I had when I was a freshman in college. You know, like she can work with heat, she can cook. But it comes from giving those opportunities as a toddler, much younger than I think traditional parenting models sort of would hand over the reins to a child. So as they're able to walk and to stand, how are you offering opportunities in the kitchen or around the house, whatever, in the kitchen specifically? You know, how are we offering opportunities to pour water, to access materials, to touch and explore food? Even so many parents are just afraid to even like let your kid put their hand in those beans that you're snapping in half to cook. And it starts with those tiny little steps in getting them comfortable and interested in what you're doing and giving them the language of what you're doing. And then offering a little bit more. So the next time, maybe your child, the first time is just playing with the beans, like green beans. And then the next time, maybe you're helping your child wash the green beans. And then the next time you're washing them and starting to snap off the ends. And over time, those skills add up. And I teach a whole course on this topic, so I could talk about it for a really long time, but it is just giving them those tiny little bits and chunks of steps, and then over time watching their interest really bloom and blossom and explode. And that's such a great opportunity, because now at 5 years old, my child can pretty much make dinner by herself if she's interested in doing that. And so it becomes helpful as a family, but it also is something that gives her great pride and great self-confidence in being able to execute those tasks.
Yeah, they're so capable and they love the contribution to the family. And I like that you mentioned that you've scaffolded the skills since she was very small. It's not like that she's just now cooking and it's safe to put your child in front of a stove because they've seen it on Instagram, but you've really built up like age-appropriate activities and going along with her capabilities. And now she's very proficient in those skills and takes it a lot further.
Exactly. And so I would never give Gus the same freedom that Nora had at that age, just because he's the same age as Nora. And so that can be the tricky part too, of seeing these things on social media, that Nora at 2.5, 3 was honestly doing far more than he does, just because he really is like, I want to just eat that food. And so that's just his personality, right? It's just, that's who he is. And so, and he is much more methodical in other ways. He might be more interested in, he can sit and unscrew things for hours, and Nora had no interest in doing those things. And so it just depends on their personality. And it's looking at your individual child and saying, where can I offer an opportunity for independence, and giving it to them and not being afraid of it creating a little bit more mess, because sometimes it will, or it taking a little more time, because it definitely will. It just is giving them that space and that time and going with the flow a little bit and offering that opportunity. And that honestly is the bulk of our work at home. The bulk of what we're doing from the ages of 0 to 6 is practical stuff. You know, Gus and I do not spend our days doing sandpaper letters and sound games, because we're busy washing windows and dusting and doing laundry.
Oh, and gardening as well. You guys like
gardening? Yeah, I don't think of gardening right now. We're recording this in February. I live in Minnesota in the United States, which we now currently have like, I don't know, 30 inches of snow on the ground. I keep watching the snow pile, like getting to almost my garden fence, the top of my garden fence. And so I just keep dreaming of the days when we'll be back out there. But yes, in the spring, in the summer, in the fall, we are outside, we're gardening, we're moving our bodies in nature. And we try to get out in the winter too, but it's just different. And
I actually really loved seeing Gus trying to move all the snow. Was that Gus?
Yes, that was Gus. Yeah. Just sit out there and shovel snow. That's what we're doing. That's our outdoor activity. We fill up our bird feeders. We are shoveling snow. That's our wintertime practical life.
And some people may not have heard of the term maximum effort. And it's when like a young child's mastered walking, but they just need to make things as difficult as possible. And so, yeah, a 3-year-old who's shoveling snow seems like that's crazy. They're too young. Why would they want to do that? But actually, just you've seen them. They're trying to pick up your bag or anything heavy. And so give them those challenges, don't you think?
Yeah, it's the perfect maximum effort activity for a 3-year-old, because shoveling snow is, while it's heavy and difficult for them, it's actually not very, like, technically very challenging. So they get a lot of self, like, enjoyment out of it, because they can do a lot of progress and like, wow, look at, I cleared that whole roll. And, you know, it doesn't require a ton of like fine motor skills or anything. So it's something that they can accomplish really easily. And they just love to move their bodies, right? And maximum effort is one of those things that when I became like more interested in Montessori, and Henry, my oldest, wasn't really, I didn't know as much about it when he was a baby and a toddler. And so really, as I've become more into Montessori and become a Montessori parent, maximum effort was one of those things like, oh, that's what he was doing, trying to carry every heavy piece of equipment in my house. Like, that's why they were pushing the chairs around. And giving them the opportunity to reach maximum effort through practical work is pretty much like, it's just the triumph for them. That's what they love to do. And so to snow is, it's the perfect thing.
I've had one child move all the chairs from one of the classrooms into the other classroom, and the mum's like going, what is going on? I said, it's okay. And then they moved them all back again, and it was just the whole fact of picking up the chair, moving it and carrying it and making it into a long line and then moving them back again. And so that is valid work, whereas we sometimes think that just seems like nonsense. We don't really understand it. But when you actually see it through their eyes, you're like, ah, this is meeting a need.
This is meeting a need. And it's so incredible to understand that that's meeting their sense of order to light it all up and to move it from one place to the next, and their that maximum effort that they're getting, moving those chairs. And as an adult, that can be kind of frustrating, especially at home. You're like, stop moving my furniture around. And to understand it from a developmental standpoint is also a real gift. And it is part of the reason that I enjoy having my children now, I think, even though there's a lot of them, to see it through that lens and see, wow, you're really developing yourself in this moment, even if it's inconvenient for me, makes those inconveniences a little bit more tolerable. And so...
And sometimes it might be annoying and you actually can stop them and say, I can see you've got a need for that, but let's do it over here. So it's not to say let them have free reign over your house. If it's something that's really irritating to you, I find that I need to step in to say, oh, that I'm actually feeling comfortable about that, but I see you need to do that, and finding an alternative.
Exactly. And like just redirect that back into some more practical or purposeful work, or put something out on your shelves. I think when I notice sometimes we had a big giant chair that one of my children was moving around, and it just wasn't safe to move it because it would tip over. And so how can I like put some jugs of water on their shelf so that I can have that opportunity for them to do that naturally, where they don't have to seek that opportunity in my environment? And so that's another thing about preparing your space is when you notice that need, like that must be lacking or could be better in my space. And how do I make that better so that their needs can be fulfilled when they want?
Yeah. And I love that you're using an example of, I don't need to go out and buy something. I'm using something that's already available in the house, and you can kind of DIY things. And over time that I've been, you know, we've been friends on Instagram and other places, I've seen you be quite a good thrift shopper and DIY. Like there was a globe, for example, that looks like a Montessori globe, but you actually had found it in a thrift store and painted it. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. And I am like, I love when I can get a good DIY. I love thrift shopping.
Have you got any favorites that you can share with us?
Oh, my favorite DIY project?
Yeah.
Oh, probably my Montessori mobiles for babies. Mm-hmm. I have a ton of them because I love them very much, but a half of them or more have been something I've made. And so I think there's a significant sense of enjoyment for myself watching my children enjoy them so much, mm-hmm. And knowing that I made that and I can give them that. And it cost me, you know, a couple of dollars in craft supplies and some time. And now, you know, all of my babies have used that. And it's so heartwarming. But yeah, the globe was another one that has sat out on our shelves for years. And it was just a cheap dollar and a half globe from a local thrift store and some acrylic paint. And I just sat and painted it the continent colors that a Montessori continent globe would have. Mm-hmm. And actually Henry helped me with that. He was like 4 years old when I did that. And so he sat and helped me paint the oceans, and we did that together. So that was another good one. I know that there are tons. My felt world map was a DIY. We've made DIY balance beams for the kids.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
And yeah, we just, wherever I can repurpose or DIY, I definitely make that sort of an important part of our environment, because I do want to not only model for my kids that we can be environmentally conscious and budget conscious, but also like we can use our hands for really purposeful work. And that sometimes is really awesome and fun to do together. And that's, you know, those are skills that we can use for a lot of different things.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we haven't talked about Teddy very much, and babies are fascinating because actually I think sometimes you have to observe them even closer because they can't just crawl away yet. You know, when they're bored, you need to be watching them to see their signs of when they maybe lose interest in an activity, or if they're showing signs of tiredness or needing for something. So what are you enjoying about Teddy now these days, and how it's been having a fourth child? Is it easy because you've done it before, or are you just constantly learning each time?
oh, I'm constantly learning about him. Mm. And I think that is like so fun and fantastic because he is, you just think like, oh, I've done this three times before, but he is a completely new human being. And I don't know this person. And I get to just like literally find out who he is as he grows and gets older and more aware. And so this past week, the thing that I've been observing and watching really carefully with him, which is, I think, such an underappreciated skill, is the use of his hands and moving one object from one hand to the other hand. And so it's just like this big, to me, like this big momentous moment in his development, because now he's ready for all this fun Montessori work. And I can't wait to like go and take out, that's one of my things I have planned for today, is going and taking out some of those next step sort of Montessori materials for him. As he's moving now, he's discovered I can open that hand and give it to my other hand. And that can lead to such fantastic discoveries for him. And I just can't wait to see where he goes and what he's interested in and how he uses that new skill.
Yeah, beautiful. And you also have been using a floor bed with Teddy, right?
Yes, he's been in a floor bed since birth.
Mm-hmm. So how did that work? Did he have like a small Moses basket at first, or did you put him straight into the floor bed and is that in your room, or how does the setup look?
We had a bassinet in our bedroom for nighttime sleeping, just because we like to room share for the first few months. And that was not a floor bed, although it's called a snooze pod. The top of it actually came off and could sit on the floor and unzip. So I loved that aspect about it, that it could move around and it could be on the floor if he had used it longer. But during the day, from the time he was born, he napped as much as possible in his bed in his room. And so we just put him in his bed, and that's where he sleeps now full time. He moved there at 3 months. Gus also followed that same path. And instead of having a crib that sort of confines your child, basically the room ends up being that sort of safe environment. So his entire bedroom is baby proofed and safe for him to explore as he's ready. And so he's rolling now, but he hasn't made his way out of bed yet. So that'll be another like major baby moment that I'm eager to watch happen, because that's always so fun when they can start moving and exploring on their own.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, what were some of the difficult moments then using a floor bed? Were there times when they'd crawl out, wake up in the middle of the night? How did you deal with those kind of things? I'm sure people have kind of like, I don't know if I would trust my child to, you know, put themselves back to sleep.
Yeah, there was. So Teddy has not gotten to that point yet. And I think there's sort of a misconception, I think, that babies will fall out of their floor bed. But the younger that you use a floor bed, in my experience, the safer they actually are. I think they're safe no matter what, but I don't think there's a very big chance of them falling out. They're very aware of the edges. Their body moves very slowly when they're little. And so as their body sort of feels for those edges, they know to like sort of recoil to a safe spot. And so when you have that tiny baby and you're worried like, wow, even that like 4 inches off the floor seems like a lot for my newborn to fall. In both my experiences with both my boys, neither of them even came close to falling off as a newborn. What we experienced with Gus is that as he could roll and move and crawl, he did find the edge of that bed. And yes, he was up in the middle of the night. But he was going to be up in the middle of the night no matter what, in my experience. Instead of getting up and crying for me, he would get up, crawl out of his bed, and we had a couple of small toys on a shelf in there, and he would go and like look at them. They were not like particularly exciting. You know, it was like a wooden ring or, a ball or something. You know, like it wasn't like anything that was like going to be loud or distracting, or like, you know, we wouldn't put a xylophone in there. But it's just some calming things or a book. And he would go and explore those materials for a little bit. And then we have a camera in his room. And so I would sit there and watch him. And he would then crawl right back to sleep. And he would just crawl back to his bed and either get all the way into his bed, or Gus really loved to use the floor bed like a pillow. So he would like slump his body over the side and like lay his head on the bed. And then I knew he would be asleep for a long time when he slept like that. And so his body would sort of be on the floor and his head on the mattress. And he loved it. He would just sleep like that so well. But he was able to like put himself back to sleep in a different way than my children. Henry and Nora were both in a crib, and they would just sit there and scream for me to come in. And the moment they were woken up, because they couldn't do anything, they couldn't move their bodies, they couldn't just get through that sleep cycle of just needing a few minutes to move around or to get comfortable again. Or there's just a sort of need to explore those new gross motor skills. I know there were so many times I would see them just like on their hands and knees, rocking or trying to crawl around. And if you give them just that few minutes in their room to explore those skills, I found it was really easy for him to just sort of either fall asleep on the floor or get back into bed and fall asleep. And so it never was this major problem for us ever. And it actually turned out to be this really incredible experience, because we could just like sit next to him as he fell asleep if we needed to. It was so much easier to lay them down, or to, if they were sick and they needed to lay by someone, you could crawl into the floor bed with them. All the things which we found really difficult with the crib.
Yeah. It's really hard to soothe a child over the bars of the side of a crib. Really, really hard.
It's really hard. And they don't want that. They want to be picked up and they want to be cuddled and they want to be close to you. And the floor bed gives you all of those opportunities while still providing sort of the limits of a crib. The limits are just the room instead of, you know, the small crib area.
Yeah, that's lovely. I also loved your, you celebrated your 10-year wedding anniversary with your husband, and you posted, I'm going to read out the caption because it was so beautiful. It said, 10 years of marriage, 2 law degrees, 7 babies, 3 children earthside, 3 dogs, 1 home, countless diapers, hours of Futurama, and very little sleep, all the love. And I just thought that was so beautiful because it captures it's very vivid in a very small caption.
Yeah, that's life. Yeah. That is the last bit of our marriage. Yeah, that's been life. And even reading that now, it's still like kind of like tears me up. That I'm so blessed to have a partner who supports me in everything that I do, and to have these children that I have, which were not a guarantee, and now Theodore on top of that, and our dogs, who I have a deep love for, and shout out to all the other Futurama fans out there, because that show is fantastic.
Your nights together, it's very special, obviously.
Yeah, it's something to dive into our history is something we bonded over when we were dating.
Did you ever find that you needed to correct him in certain ways? Because obviously you've read up a lot about Montessori, and they sometimes a partner might be falling behind in some ways. How did you cope with educating a partner? I think that's a common question that I get.
Yeah, it is a common question. I get that too a lot. How do I get my husband to read about this stuff? And I have to say that my husband does not read Montessori books. He's not like sitting around on the weekends reading Montessori. And so I think the most important thing that you can do is model. And just like your children, I hate to compare my husband to a toddler, but much like a toddler, you have to model for them. And so be the person that you want to be, the parent that you want to be, and let them see it work. My husband was very skeptical about doing some of the things, especially practical life stuff and cooking and kitchen work in the beginning. Not only because he didn't understand sort of the theory and the mechanics behind it, but because it makes him nervous. Like, I don't want to give my toddler a knife. Like, what are you doing? But modeling that for him and being that patient model and letting Montessori show him how fantastically capable your child is. And so sort of just plowing ahead and doing it and saying, wow, he could use that knife really efficiently, really safely. And look at how happy it made him, and look at how awesome this was. And so I think that's the biggest thing you can do is just sort of let Montessori shine through with your child and model for yourself. Like, be that calm person. If it's a behavioral issue that you want to stop relying on punishments or consequences or something like that, and you're trying to take a different approach, a more peaceful approach, you know, take that approach yourself and show your husband or your partner how it can be and how easy it can be. And then I think there are conversations that you have to have, and you're going to have to sit down and just, you know, say like, this isn't just how we're doing that. This is why we're doing it, and sort of have those deeper philosophical conversations of how do we want our family to feel? And what do you want it to be like when you come home during, you know, or what should we structure our life as? And not sort of getting wrapped up in the day-to-day, like, minutia of changing diapers and washing clothes, and but how do we want this to feel when we look back, as we bring that back to that, you know, memory of childhood? Like, what do you want our children's memories to be? Do we want it to be, you know, running around and doing everything, or do we want it to feel more peaceful? Do we want it to be a situation where, you know, we're relying on cooperation versus coercion, or whatever it is? And having those conversations, and then saying, here's something that might help. And then there's always good old Facebook Messenger, where I send him and bombard him with articles, probably several of yours, Simone. And so I just keep sending him. Even if he reads one or two every now and then, I'll call that a win. So I'm not expecting him to sit down and read Montessori and make that his passion to understand the ins and outs of The Secret of Childhood, one of my favorite Montessori book. But, you know, just giving him those glimpses and being really honest and open and getting on the same page as much as possible. And sorry, I'm going on and on about this now, but
that's good. I think it'll be really helpful, but please finish.
You know, you have to just be okay with the fact that sometimes your spouse is going to take a different approach than you. There are times when Morgan, my husband, will do something differently than I would have handled that. And I'm going to be okay with it. I'm not going to let that become an issue between me and my spouse, or between my spouse and my child. I'm going to let it go and give my husband the grace to figure it out and to take up the approach that feels best for him. And much like a guide in a Montessori classroom, I've seen a bunch, you know, been in a ton of Montessori classrooms now, and having children be in a bunch of them, no guide takes the exact same approach towards a child, and even the same guide between children takes different approaches. And so giving your spouse the space to do that and to find their own rhythm is so helpful for you, and just takes the pressure off that situation.
Yeah, that's really valuable to hear. I think that will be really helpful for people, definitely. And I even question, like, okay, apart from children, you have your relationship with your partner, and how do you maintain a relationship with your partner even though you have four children? Because I'm sure you're very tired at the end of the days, and you're waking up at nights, and sometimes you're just like, seriously, I can't give to one more person right now. How do you make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that is a valid feeling, right? Like, I am touched out. I do not want to deal with you right now. Like, I don't want to make that a priority. And so I think there are taking time for yourself. Morgan and I both have times set up throughout the month where we are going out individually without each other to hang out with friends. So that we both have that space that we feel like, oh, we got some of me time, and then we can come together and have some us time. And then we're really flexible about what you would consider like a date. We don't have a ton of childcare. We don't live near family. And so we just have dates at home. And so we're very flexible about making that time. And even if that date is spending 5 minutes away from our phones at the end of the night, just going over, you know, how the day was, that's a date, that's connection. And so I think we're very intentional about leaving our media behind. It's for at least a few minutes every day to connect with one another, just talking and just talking just for those few minutes. And usually it's like 5 minutes before the baby wakes up, and then it's like, all right, see you later. Like, and then we're, you know, that we're off on our things. And the other thing is, we are fortunate enough to live in a city where we can bring in take-in. And so we'll put the kids to bed, and we will feed the kids dinner at their regular time, put them to bed, and, you know, have a late dinner together at home, and just spend those moments together, and or watching TV, you know, for a half an hour before bed, and just honestly sneaking in those moments, and understanding that our relationship is what will be the foundation for everything else that goes on in our family. And so never neglecting that, where we feel like I don't know where he's at or what he's doing. But still giving us time apart. Like, we can't always be together. And so I feel much more connected in my relationship and much more available to him when I can go out and have dinner with my mom friends. And I can still, I play a game called Bunko. It's a dice game with some friends once a month. And so if I can go and get my monthly Bunko on and hang out with friends and do something for myself, I'm much more available in my relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that Instagram post about your marriage, it does refer to the fact that you do have babies that are on the other side. Are you comfortable to talk to us about that at all?
I am. Yeah. So yeah, we had 4 losses between Nora and Henry. And and we were at a point where, especially, you know, after the third or fourth, now it's been a couple of years, so I can't remember the details. But at one point, our reproductive endocrinologist, our doctor that we were at, must have been after the third, was just like, you know, it's not guaranteed that you're going to have any more kids. Like, and it was sort of callous of him to say, you know, like, just be happy with the one you have, right? That was sort of his way of saying that. He was not a very good doctor, in hindsight. But those words have stuck with me, in that I do have 3 other children now, and it's sort of come full circle that I have 4 children who aren't here and 4 who are. And just it provides an perspective of, you know, you never really know what tomorrow brings, and it allows me to feel so much joy in the children that I know I have, but while also, you know, always wondering at some place what could have been. And so it is something that even years later I think about, and it has become who I am, deeply ingrained and in who I am as a parent and who I am as a human and as a woman, that this is part of my story. And I think it's important to talk about miscarriage and baby loss in that way, because so many of us carry those burdens on a daily basis, and it doesn't just go away because we are quiet about it. I think it's 1 in 4 pregnancies are lost to miscarriage. And so chances are, you know, someone that has had a miscarriage, and that's why I've been so open about our journey and talking about our losses, because people go through this, and this is a really hard time to try to be alone. And if you're out there listening and you're going through a pregnancy loss of some kind, you know that you aren't alone, and know that there are resources out there and there are people out there that can help you get through this, and know that it might be who you are for the rest of your life, that you've have this, but you will get through it, and you can find the joy in your life moving forward.
Yeah. And if that you were supporting someone who had been through a miscarriage, what did you find the most helpful? Just someone to listen to? Like you said, you found it really unhelpful what the doctor had said. Mm-hmm.
I found it really helpful when people just said, I'm here. Like, I'm here for you. And I acknowledge your loss. You know, it's not, I can come up with a lot of unhelpful examples, but it's just acknowledging that, like, you lost something. This was hard for you, and I'm here if you need something. I'm here to listen. I'm here to provide physical support, you know, taking your child for a couple of hours so you can be alone, or, you know, babysitting so you can go to the doctor, or just sleep, take a bath, whatever it is that you need. Recognizing that for a time there was life that you were expecting, and then now there's not, and that's a big deal, whether or not you're losing a pregnancy at 6 weeks or you're losing a pregnancy at, you know, 12 or 16 or wherever, you're losing that expectation and that life, and that's a very real loss for you. And just the acknowledgement of that was very, very helpful.
And thank you for being so vulnerable. That's really helpful. And also helpful for people who are supporting other people. Oh, that's a lot. But
it is a lot, yeah. But it's good to talk about. It's good, and that healing comes, and you can find joy. And I'm not going to lie, like, pregnancy is not an easy part, an easy for me. And having been pregnant now three additional times after those losses, it does take a toll on your mental health to be so worried about that, because that is always going to be in the back of your mind. But you can get through it, and that's the good thing to know, that like, we can do this and still feel joy in those children that come after.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And now that we're getting to the end of this lovely conversation, which I just don't want it to end, I wanted to come back to, like, what does Montessori then mean for you? There's so many parts of it. And how do you express to people, like, this is what Montessori means to me?
Oh, Montessori for me, yeah, it's joy. And it really brings the joy to my family in a way that I don't think we would have without it. It's joy in being able to see my children as individuals and as being on their own path. And it's joy in knowing that I don't have to be this frantic micromanager of everything. It's joy in the spaces that we create, in knowing and understanding why we're putting things into our home and the reasons that we're having our home be the way that it is. It's joy in watching their education unfold, and watching, you know, them develop in this way that is so natural. And like, every accomplishment, Nora literally just read her first early reader earlier this week, and the joy on her face as she completed that book could bring me to tears. I literally, to know that every part of that was her own accomplishment and that she did that on her own free will is a gift that I don't think she would be getting outside of Montessori. And just being a Montessori parent has honestly changed everything about our family and has brought us so much closer together and given us the freedom and sort of grace to do all of this with so much happiness. And I just love that.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much. We're so grateful to you, Nicole, for sharing so much on Instagram. We love that you're addicted to it and posting like updates because we get to see it really, you know, put into practice every day, from the smallest things like an activity to, you know, a child making food and how capable they can be, to just your presence with your children intentionally setting up spaces and your grace doing it all. And I'm sure people will definitely follow along. So can you give your Instagram handle and the website as well?
Sure. It's NickCav25. That's NICKAV 25. And my website is thecavanaughreport.com.
Great. And I'll put those links in the show notes as well. So if you're on the go, you can go and check them out and definitely follow along. You'll continue to be inspired. And also watch this space, because Nicole's going to be launching her own podcast very soon. So she'll be announcing that, I'm sure, on Instagram and her website. So Nicole, thanks again for coming on today. And I hope it won't be too long before we get to chat again.
Dude, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
So I loved getting to chat to Nicole, and I hope you got lots of inspiration as well. I loved hearing her, how she gets her children to help each other when she's not available. And I think it's a really nice reminder that we can be our children's guide, like supporting them, but not having to solve everything for them ourselves or even instantaneously. So I'll put links to Nicole's website and Instagram in the show notes. And she also has a new podcast called Shelf Help, which I'm sure will help spread the Montessori love even further. So the show notes can be found at themontessorinotebook.com, and then you can click on the podcast tab. And now it's time for our listener question. This week, our question comes from Nora, and she asks, "My 2.9-year-old boy is very active, and I always find it hard to stop him from throwing the toys and hitting his sister. Now in quarantine, it got worse. He sometimes has episodes of total destruction lasting almost 15 minutes, throwing anything in front of him, running away, hitting everybody, and laughing. I take him to a quiet room and explain that I cannot let him do that. I read your book, but he continues. Do you think I should change something in his routine or activities, or just continue to react the same when it happens?"
So thanks, Nora. I'm sure you're not alone right now, because when it's hard to get out as much and we have young toddlers who need to move, it's going to be sometimes really difficult to keep meeting all their needs. So the first thing I'd suggest is what all Montessori teachers tend to say, and that would be to observe. And like when what I mean is to observe when it happens. Is it always with their sister? What time of day are you or your partner around? And does something seem to trigger it? And when we look at it objectively, we can sometimes see some patterns. And indeed, we might see that we might need to change the activities. For example, throwing can often be a sign that something's too hard or too easy, or they're simply getting bored with it. You know, you can imagine that if they've seen the same toys for an hour a week, they're going to be throwing more. So rotating toys to make sure they're providing some challenge would be really helpful, and removing ones when you notice they're being thrown or not being used so much. So that might be definitely something to look into. And I'm not sure if it's a younger or an older sister, but this could also be a way of saying that they're getting in his way. A baby, for example, that's just started crawling or walking can take over the physical space in a different way, interrupt activities. And so it might be, you know, basically his behavior is communicating that he is having a hard time, and we can help him then to communicate, you know, how he's feeling, or to possibly just even set up a space where he won't be so disturbed. And it's just a lot sounding like he needs to move. And are there ways that he can throw things that aren't toys, you know, to set up maybe some target practice with washi tape, for example, to make some circles, and then some soft balls to hit the target, or setting up a place where he can go and climb, or maybe a punching bag to hit, or some maximum effort activities like we talked about with Nicole, you know, moving heavy objects so that they're moving and working every muscle of their body, and or maybe an obstacle course, things like that, you know, ways to get him involved so he feels useful. That can also be really helpful. I'd also suggest that when we get recurring behavior, we can be observing and stepping in really early at the first signs that he's starting to get triggered. And hopefully then it won't escalate into a 15-minute episode. And like we can, exactly as you say, can be kind and clear. I can't let you hit your sister. And I would like saying, like, it's my job to keep everyone safe. And then we can really support him by trying to see his perspective and translate for him. So like, give him the skills. What did you want to tell her? Are you having a hard time right now? And then he learns that we're on his side, and you know, he knows that we're there for him. The hardest part, I think, is when they laugh, because it's easier in a way to understand if they're melting down and to give them some empathy. But to me, his behavior is likely communicating that he is dysregulated, even if he's laughing, and we can let him know that we're there to help. So I hope this helps, Nora, and to other listeners as well who are feeling a little trapped right now. And that is it for today. And I'll be back next week with a conversation with Juniper from Enduamo, who has become a dear friend. She's based in Nigeria. She has three children. She set up a Montessori school there, has done the 0-3 training, 3-6 training, and she's nearly finished a 6-12 training, and is the youngest member of the AMI board. So you want to join me next week to find out how she does it all with such grace. And we'll also be announcing a secret project that we've been working on together, which I've been teasing, I think, since last summer, those of you who've been following along for a while. And we need some fun things to look forward to right now, right? So I'll see you back here next Friday. And in the meantime, stay positive, everyone, and keep well.
Thanks for joining me for the Montessori Notebook podcast. The podcast was edited by Luke Davis from Filmprov Media, and podcast art by Hiyoko Imai. To find out more about me and my online courses, visit themontessorinotebook.com, follow me on Instagram at @themontessorinotebook, or pick up a copy of my book, The Montessori Toddler, from your local bookstore, Amazon, or where books are sold. It's also available as an ebook, audiobook, and has been translated into over 20 languages. I'll be back in a week with more Montessori inspiration, and in the meantime, perhaps you'll join me in spreading some more peace and positivity around the world.